Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm looking at the myths and religions of the world and thinking about how to use them in our fantasy role-playing games. In our current season, we're looking at Hawaiian myth and religion. In our previous episode, we looked at one of the four great gods, Kane. And in this episode, we're going to take a look at another one, Ku, along with his consort, wife, other self, Hina. I reserve the right to return to Hina later on because she does crop up and indeed arguably maybe play a more important role in the mythologies of some other figures that we're going to be talking about. But let's start with Ku himself. Ku, like Kane and like all Hawaiian deities really, is a god with many aspects. He is a god of farming, of fishing, of war, of sorcery, and of politics. He is probably most famous these days for his association with Kamehameha I, the conqueror who united the various polities of the Hawaiian Islands into the Kingdom of Hawaii. This aspect of Ku is called Ku Ka'ili Moku, Ku the Snatcher of Land, or of Lands. Ku has been interpreted in a number of different ways. We've talked about the writing of the folklorist Martha Warren Beckwith, and Beckwith tends to think that Ku is a sort of male principle, together with Hina, a sort of ancestor figure for the whole nation, and associated with what are considered to be masculine pursuits, like war and politics, and that he's one half of a kind of like fertility-generating couple. She points out that there are a number of tales in which a hero of some kind is revealed to be the child of Ku and Hina, a bit like turning out to be secretly a prince in a fairy tale. In a previous episode, we mentioned some of Ku's various aspects. So we talked about Ku Ka'ili Moku, of course. I mentioned the god of sorcerers, Ku Waha'ilo, Ku of the maggot-dropping mouth, which is a really horrid image, and some of the different ways in which he's associated with kind of like agriculturally productive or other like food productive occupations. But he has also got a number of like connections to other occupations. So for example, Ku Moku Hali'i is a patron of canoe builders. As you might expect from a god who has so many different aspects, Ku's worship is kind of spread throughout the community. We get obviously like very important high status political associations, which we'll talk about in a moment when we talk about the statues of Ku that Kamehameha is associated with. But also Ku appears in many like features of the landscape. So there are lots of boulders, for instance, that are said to be connected with Ku in some way. And a lot of these have some kind of, I guess, kapu associated with them, where you're not supposed to like disturb the boulder or strike it or anything like that, or you will be cursed. You know, you'll have bad weather or like a disaster will happen. This is something that I think is one of those features of real world mythology that is not very common in role playing games, which is places where the divine is present in the landscape. And of course, as always, I have to put a footnote here and say that this is not true of Glorantha. But many cultures and societies have these types of origin stories for natural features. And those natural features are treated with, you know, a particular respect or are involved in certain festivities. And I think partly what we're seeing here is the way in which Dungeons and Dragons tends to take a polytheistic faith, but imagine that clerics behave like Christian clergy and that temples are a bit like Christian churches. What this means is that insofar as we get these kinds of things in a setting, they're often attributed to humans, to an equivalent of what we might think of as saints. But if you look at the mythology of Hawaii, you will see that it is full of stories in which Ku and Kane and Lano and Kanaloa and all the different deities of the Hawaiian pantheon move around a recognizably Hawaiian landscape, and indeed are said to like live in certain places on the islands or to have lived there, like that they move around a bit. So there are poems and there are tales that make it clear that they live in some kind of heaven, and there are also ones where they live, you know, in houses in Hawaii like their people. The apparent contradiction is not that big a problem for these stories. Similarly, they're often described in human terms. So one of the stories that is reprinted in Beckwith's Hawaiian mythology describes the different aspects of ku as if they were just all members of the same family. So we see multiple aspects of ku talking to each other and referring to each other as brothers. And sometimes these are brothers, and sometimes they are the same person. And again, there's a difference contextually, but I don't think that it's sort of considered to be very important. In a previous episode, I mentioned the song Aloha Oe, composed by Queen Liliuokalani. And that's kind of like the piece of music that you think of when you think of Hawaii. And the image that you think of when you think of the gods of Hawaii. So if you think, you know, in your mind, what does a Hawaiian deity look like? Insofar as you have a mental image, it's almost certainly a particular statue of Kuka'ili Moku. As I mentioned, Kuka'ili Moku was a patron deity of Kamehameha I, or even just before he was Kamehameha I, he had a role in the court of his cousin, Kiwalao, as the guardian of Kuka'ili Moku. So he had the responsibility of looking after these statues and I guess probably the heiau that were associated with them of Kuka'ili Moku. And this was a position of, you know, of great responsibility. This was a pretty like prominent role at the court for a royal relative. So the distinction between secular and religious authority, again, not super clear in this context. During and after his campaigns, Kamehameha I ordered these big statues of ku to be established at certain areas that were associated with his dynasty. Three of these statues still exist today. One is in Hawaii, one is in the British Museum, and one is in the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. I don't want to get too much into the politics of repatriation. It's something that I, you know, studied because my background is as an archaeologist, but in general, because sort of my specialist field of study was in Europe, these kinds of debates about the restoration of cultural heritage are, well, I mean, not even Europe, but specifically in England, these kinds of debates about the restoration of cultural heritage are a much less significant part of what people who study the archaeology of England do, although they do exist. I don't want to downplay them, but they're, you know, compared to the contentious issues that we get in the United States or in other colonized places, they're maybe a little further from the center of the field. And therefore, I don't have that much experience with it. And I defer to people who have more. In the United States, there's a thing called NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And what that means is that the descendant communities of indigenous communities can file a claim under this act to have, in particular, like human remains or other grave objects, but sort of cultural heritage in general, repatriated. And while a claim was made for this statue of ku that's in this museum in Salem, it was eventually withdrawn, and I guess a settlement was reached. I don't know the details at all. And there was a whole big ceremony to sort of consecrate the space within the museum. The ceremony was an interesting one because it had certain features that I've started to become familiar already, including dressing the statue of ku. So we saw that sort of when we talked about the stones of Kane, that they were covered with a cloth, and there's some suggestion that the stones are sort of a phallic symbol, and that therefore this is a bit like, you know, dressing, like putting on appropriate clothing for a ritual. And similarly, you know, the wooden statue of ku was given cloth, well, sort of a loincloth or a kilt to wear during this ceremony, but doesn't wear it all the time. The images are remarkable. I urge you to just Google it. Just Google, you know, like ku Hawaiian god or something, and you'll see them. You can see why they were appealing to people. They have a tremendous expression of kind of ferocity or aggressiveness. This is definitely ku in his role as a war god. And they were purchased by sea captains, British and American sea captains, from, I presume, members of the Hawaiian noble and priestly classes who had converted to Christianity and didn't want these statues of old Hawaiian gods around anymore. And there's, of course, this is what everyone always says, but they claim that this, you know, effectively this prevented them from being destroyed, that if they'd been left in situ, they would just have been like burned or thrown out or whatever, because the newly Christianized population didn't want to keep around these reminders of their pagan heritage. Whether that's true or not, I couldn't tell you. And I don't want to suggest that I'm saying this justifies anything, but that is the story. I mentioned that Ku is a war god and was associated, in fact, with both sides of the conflicts. Well, there's more than two sides, really, of the conflicts that eventually resulted in the unification of Hawaii. One example of this is the Battle of Nu'uanu. So this is a battle that was fought on Oahu in 1795, right toward the end of the sort of wars that would result in unification. So in 1795, Kamehameha took advantage of a civil war on Oahu following the death of Kahekili II, who was the chief of the island at that time. You know, there was a succession crisis following his death that left Oahu vulnerable, and Kamehameha attempted to exploit that vulnerability. Kamehameha had been equipping his army with muskets and cannon. He assembled his forces and invaded Oahu. The leader of the Oahu forces was Kalanikupule, and he was not only king of Oahu, but also had a claim, this was partly what that civil war was about, to the kingdom of Maui. So the battle was complex and interesting. It involved some real kind of exciting adventure story stuff. For instance, as Kamehameha's forces are approaching the positions of Kalanikupule's army, they are coming under fire from Kalanikupule's cannons, and Kamehameha sends one portion of his forces to like climb the heights and take the artillery positions. It's all quite dramatic, and it ends with a famous scene in which Oahuan warriors are either pushed off or you know, leap off this cliff to get away from the advancing Hawaiians, or, you know, rather than be captured. And the reason that I mention this is that Kalanikupule hides out for a while following the battle, but is eventually captured by Kamehameha, and he is sacrificed to Ku. So human sacrifice is part of Ku's worship, and here is associated with, like, victory in battle as something that Ku has to be thanked for. Now, not every story relating to Ku is so violent. And he's a god of war and of sovereignty, but also a god of agriculture. And so there's a story of Ku and Hina in which, in response to a famine, Ku comes to Hina and says, "I can provide food for this famine, but I will have to go away and never return." And of course, Hina doesn't want that, but some time passes, the situation keeps getting worse. Ku's children are hungry, and they tell him so, and he comes to Hina again and says, "You know, once again, I can solve this, but I will not return." And Hina reluctantly consents to whatever it is that Ku has in mind, because the situation is so dire. And Ku goes out of their house, and, you know, in front of their home, he stands, he turns upside down, stands on his head, and, like, disappears into the earth. And Hina, you know, is sad that her husband has vanished, and sort of waters that place with her tears, but from that ground grows the ulu, the breadfruit. And so, you know, this is seen as an example of Ku sacrificing himself to provide for the community as a whole. I got that story from, like, the Hawaiian Breadfruit Council, or the Breadfruit Festival, which, if I am to believe the page of the Hawaiian Breadfruit Council or whoever, is a wonder crop that is capable of many things. But the point is that this is a, I was going to say it's a dichotomy, but I think it is not perceived as a dichotomy. It's just that Ku has many aspects, you know, and perhaps in the idea that he is both someone who, like, confers authority on kings and brings victory in battle, but also a provider for the people, for the community, that we can see that this is perhaps ideally what a king, a chief, an ali'i is supposed to be like. Speaking of Hina, Hina is Ku's wife, although not, there are multiple Hinas, possibly. Hina is a common name for goddesses, not just in Hawaii, but in Polynesian religion generally. There are multiple Hawaiian deities or legendary people named Hina. Beckwith is very into the idea that Hina presents some kind of divine feminine counterpart to Ku, but I don't know that that is a good summary of Hina, although that may be what Hina does in stories that are about Ku and Hina. But there are lots of stories about Hina, or potentially a different character also called Hina, that are not Ku and Hina stories. Does that make sense? At least one of these Hinas is the mother of the legendary hero Maui, about whom we will have more to say later. Somewhere around here, I have got Richard Adams, like the Watership Down fella. He wrote a book about Hina and Maui, although seen through the lens of Tahitian rather than Hawaiian mythology. It's called The Legend of Te Tuna. Beckwith says, quote, "The various Hinas in this story are not very clearly differentiated," close quotes, which is something of an understatement. And Beckwith also associates Hina with another Hawaiian deity, Pele, about whom, again, we will have more to say later. In a lot of these stories, Hina is associated with the sea or with water, which would make her a nice counterpart for Ku if we read Ku as associated with the earth. I guess that makes sense. But I would say that association with Ku does not seem to be Hina's main thing. It's either a term that encompasses many divine ladies or a figure who weds or mothers a range of different gods and heroes. One example of this is the tale of Hina of the Baler. And here we have Maui is attempting to fish some islands up out of the sea with his magic fish hook. And Hina warns Maui not to take... Well, this is actually one version of the story. There are many versions of the story, but in one of them, from Kauai, he takes a gourd baler and puts it in his canoe, and it transforms into a beautiful woman, Hina Keka, Hina of the Baler, or Hina of the Baler. But because she is so beautiful, Maui's rowers are distracted, and the land is not, like, pulled up completely, right? So it remains an archipelago of islands. My difficulty in understanding Hina is... I like to, you know, if I'm going to find a good thing about it and not just feel like a dummy, I will say that this is just kind of what this body of myths is like, right? There is no unified central document. There was never meant to be a unified central document. And I don't think that most people were very concerned about the fact that the myths cannot be reconciled into a single continuity. They're not meant to be. They are individual stories which have individual ritual, individual sacred purposes, or individual narrative purposes. And I'm just going to have to live with that fact. So I wouldn't say that I have a very clear account of Hina. I think she's something that we're going to have to develop as the season goes on. But I do think that Ku is a pretty good patron for, you know, I mean, obviously he's associated with farming, but he's sort of ever present in the land. He's quite demanding and a little bloodthirsty, right? Human sacrifice, that's a tricky issue. We're going to have to talk about, we talked about it in the Aztec section, but this is a society where human sacrifice, like, it's not common, but it's certainly not unheard of, and it's not disapproved of. It just only happens at certain very specific times. So I feel like what we have here is a good patron for fighter types. In a Hawaiian-inspired game, I would say that those characters are probably, but not necessarily, associated with the Ali'i, the chiefly class. And I think we see Ku, you know, potentially as a patron of that class also. But at the same time, you know, not exclusively. And maybe not exclusively for fighters either, right? Ku does have some aspects in which he appears as a friend of farmers, a friend of the common man. So a very versatile deity, and one who can appear in different guises. So, you know, on the one hand, perhaps Ku of the Digging Stick is the friend of the ordinary Hawaiian taro grower, and Ku, the snatcher of land, is more associated with kind of higher status, like territorial conquest. And then, of course, the outliers like Ku Waha'ilo, the god of sorcerers, who is also, I think, associated with thunderstorms. I could be wrong about that, but I think he's associated with bad weather. I think he's a really versatile god. And we've seen Kane as kind of like maybe a slightly abstract character, you know, a sky god sort of elevated. In all of his roles, Ku seems a little earthier, a little more in contact with the day-to-day concerns, the flesh and blood concerns of human beings, of mortals. All right. That's about all the Hawaiian deities that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to take a look at the last two of the four great gods as we look at Lono and Kanaloa. So I hope that you will join me then. For Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.